You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the June 2020 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Vanity Fair Awards Extra, United We Watch, a special section celebrating must-see Emmy-worthy television with Succession's Sarah Snook, plus Catherine O'Hara, Zoe Kravitz, Patrick Stewart, Kristen Bell, Whoopi Goldberg, Bowen Yang, Julia Garner, Bob Odenkirk, Baby Yoda, and many more. Opening photograph directed by Jackie Nickerson. TV, live to stream. Television connects us now more than ever. Our chief critic sets the scene by Richard Lawson. In mid-March, as the reality of our quarantine circumstances was swiftly setting in, a friend asked me what essential movies they should watch to pass the time. I tossed off a few suggestions, but quickly found myself turning to television shows instead. It just made more sense to steer someone toward a 6 or 10, maybe even 20-hour viewing adventure in this time of, well, so much time. There was a visit to Schitt's Creek to be enjoyed, the jittery paranoia of homeland to return to, a state of euphoria to be experienced, an almost absurd abundance of television. Actual good television lies out there, waiting to be seen, a varied landscape we pay tribute to in this issue as Emmy season begins to ramp up. We haven't abandoned movies by any means. I personally have enjoyed catching up on a lot of missed classics while sheltering in place, but television, in all its comforting sprawl, has often seemed the better option. The coronavirus outbreak forced an already developing narrative into hyperspeed. The movie theaters closed and audiences flocked in even bigger droves than before to conventional TV and particularly to streaming platforms. A new marketing angle bloomed overnight as content providers realized their situational power. TV could act in some ways as a savior, occupying our attention to keep us committed to our social distancing. Television became, rather surprisingly, a tool in the fight against a pandemic. Of course, applications like Zoom, FaceTime, and Skype also helped people come together, beaming into one another's screens from the confines of their atomized lives. But there, in the background of all that virtual socializing, was television, the connective tissue of the isolation experience. The emblem of that phenomenon is, almost certainly, Netflix's Tiger King, a documentary series that arrived just as millions of Americans were banished to their houses for an indefinite stretch of weeks. Even though the series is pretty bleak in its depiction of the follies of American life, it was so nice to all gawp at something filmed in the time before, together. Sure, reactions were staggered, with some viewers a couple of days or episodes behind others. But we were all still collectively heaving toward the show's conclusion. It was bonding, this collective binge, a convocation that didn't seem feasible in a time of isolation. For all its strange darkness, Tiger King is likely to be one of the TV watersheds of this troubled year, a classic forged in the fires of panic. The television of old used to draw people together. Scant offerings meant limited choice, while streaming and the wilds of the vaster Internet seemed to push us all out on our own private vectors. This crisis, though, has gathered many of us closer again, Millions of couches all pointed at the same flickering light for days on end. Lucky for us, then, that the glowing boxes of our fascination have so much to offer, the best of which you'll see in the following pages. I cannot wait to rush back out to a movie theater, happily awash in its bigness and the cozy formalities of public ritual. But when this is all over, I think I might still, on occasion, see if a friend or two want to stream a show together and compare notes over text, not as a replacement for any cherished old rite, but as an addition, yet another way to manage the great adventure set before us in the age of peak everything, which is, of course, to watch as much as we can. still more from the awards extra, Making a Scene. A television show's vision begins taking shape long before the actors learn their lines, let alone speak them. Vanity Fair talks to miracle workers in design, makeup, writing, and more, by Katie Rich. In the photos, Suit Up, a plot against America mood board, courtesy of Jerriana San Juan. Maternal Instinct, Zoe Kazan as Bess Levin, a fictionalized version of Philip Roth's mother. First Couple, Ben Cole and Caroline Kaplan as Charles Lindbergh and Anne Morrow Lindbergh. A Stitch in Time. In this alternate history, President Lindbergh preaches isolationism, an attractive prospect to Winona Ryder's glamorous but misguided Evelyn Finkel. The Fabric of History. Inspired costumes reinvent America's past and present. It's hard enough for an elaborate historical drama to accurately represent America as it once was. It's another thing entirely to show the nation as it might have been if the forces of history had played out differently. That's the challenge that faced costume designer Jerriana San Juan on HBO's The Plot Against America, an adaptation of Philip Roth's 2004 novel. It's set in a World War II-era America, in which an isolationist, fascism-friendly Charles Lindbergh has become president and prevented the country from entering the war. The premise allowed San Juan to use materials that were rationed in reality, like rubber-soled tennis shoes for the child characters or elaborate gowns designed for a state dinner at the Lindbergh White House. I really indulged in silk in a way that wouldn't have normally been embraced in the early 1940s, she says, describing a red silk cape she designed for Winona Ryder's character. The state dinner scene features gowns with elaborate beading and rhinestones that are the antithesis of the practical wartime fashion that emerged in real life. And the tattered clothes worn by the Jewish family at the center of the story, who are suffering under the Lindbergh regime. That was very carefully calculated, San Juan says. I wanted to show the utmost opulence and luxury in contrast to the Levin family. Next photos, Speak Out. Rose Byrne's Gloria Steinem and Kate Blanchett's Phyllis Schlafly show their true colors in Mrs. America. And Thunder from Down Under. Spoiler alert, the mask singer's glam kangaroo was actually model Jordan Woods. Costume designer Bina Daigler stuck closer to the record for FX on Hulu's limited series Mrs. America, finding inspiration in a number of historical photos, though she still had some significant gaps to fill. The show stars Kate Blanchett as the late conservative firebrand Phyllis Schlafly, who managed almost single-handedly to mount a successful campaign against the Equal Rights Amendment. The series follows Schlafly through the 1970s and across many of her iconic public moments, including a Phil Donahue show appearance for which she wore a bright orange polyester dress. Daigler calls those the hero moments, but the show, which also follows the lives and work of second-wave feminist icons like Gloria Steinem, Bella Abzug, and Shirley Chisholm, tracks its characters off the public stage and into their homes as well, offering intimate moments that were never part of the public record. So, Daigler had to both capture history and expand on it, with the help of collaborators like Blanchett, who was also an executive producer on the series. Talking with Kate, somehow we agreed that Phyllis always was very, very put together, Daigler says. She was not somebody who would spend a day in a house dress because she was very much in charge and commanding. Their instinct, it turns out, was dead on. As Schlafly's daughter Anne Schlafly, Corey, told Vanity Fair in April, "I never saw her in pajamas." Next photos, action figure, Cheyenne Jackson as an actor playing Hooded Justice in a show within the show. All white, Megan Kasperlick's rendering of a dress for Hong Chau's Lady Tu. Time for change. Regina King plays Angela Abar, who fights crime as costumed hero Sister Knight. Below the belt, a mysterious contraption that belongs to a mysterious man, Adrian Veidt, played by Jeremy Irons. Like its network mate, The Plot Against America, HBO's Watchmen unfolds in an alternate reality, a present in which America is different, not because of presidential politics, but thanks to the influence of things such as a blue super being named Dr. Manhattan and a giant squid attack on New York City. The show, which takes place after that event, and others from Alan Moore and Dave Gibbons' legendary Watchmen comics from the 1980s, also includes flashbacks to this world's first superhero, Hooded Justice, who lives in a recognizable facsimile of the 1940s. I made sure that the fabrications were not high-tech fabrics for that time period, says costume designer Megan Kasperlick. There wasn't super spandex and 3D printing and all of the things that we use now for a lot of our superhero projects and films. For Lady Tru, an enigmatic trillionaire with a futuristic vibe, Kasperlick drew on her background in fashion. It was really cool to be able to make her look a little bit more of the sci-fi character, with a little bit more modernized elements, she says. The rest of the vigilantes were supposed to be characters who made their own costumes. Fox's reality competition, The Masked Singer, exists in a universe all its own, to say the least. To conceal each contestant's identity, Emmy-winning costume designer Marina Troibina turns stars like Chaka Khan and Jordan Woods into furry characters like Miss Monster and Kangaroo. There's no rule book, no historical references. I just kind of dive into my crazy mind and try to figure out what it is that we can do that's a step ahead, she says. But even if her over-the-top mask singer costumes don't represent real history, Troibina sees a poignant connection to what the world is living through now. We're masked away from one another, she says. It's definitely sitting on my mind, what I can do to bring light to the situation with the show. If there's anything even more compelling than the mysteries of the past, it's the mystery of what happens next. With additional reporting by Hilary Bussis, Julie Miller, and Joanna Robinson. Still more from the awards extra, Creature Feature, Birthing Baby Yoda by Katie Rich. In the photos, How to Succeed, Hapless Tom, Matthew McFadyen, and Sharp Shiv, Sarah Snook, plot in a sumptuous hallway. Close Encounter, the creature, formerly known as the Child, enjoys a tender moment with Pedro Pascal's Mask Mandalorian. When designing the Child, now known to all humankind as Baby Yoda, the Mandalorian creator Jon Favreau ran into an unexpected problem. His Star Wars youngling was actually too cute. Favreau and his partner, Dave Filoni, weren't trying to craft a toothachingly adorable insta-meme. They wanted a believable creature whose presence could help audiences connect with their show's laconic, helmeted bounty hunter lead, played by Pedro Pascal. "We had a guy in a mask and we had a puppet," says Favreau. "We knew it was still a gamble." Their enchanting green guy wound up breaking the internet with his wide eyes and teeny force-wielding hands, but the duo had to resist the cutesy factor all the way. They rejected early concept art and merchandise designs that turned the Child, with his odd fingers and scraggly hairs, into a rosy-cheeked Disney baby. In one design, he had cute teeth, Favreau recalls. "We made them more jagged and sharp, the better to swallow an entire frog with." And this story was actually by Joanna Robinson. The next story, Rich Interiors, is by Katie Rich. Feathering Succession's Nest. If Succession has a single signature shot, it might be a fleet of black town cars pulling up to an elegant estate. The second season of HBO's acerbic drama traveled to a series of spectacular real-world mansions and one super yacht, locations that required a bit of finessing from production designer Stephen Carter. For example, the Long Island mansion that became Turnhaven, the ancestral home of the antagonistic Pierce family, was already pretty much perfect, right down to the candle-powered chandelier that hung over the dining table where most of the episode's action unfolds. But Carter and his team had to spend some time settling things down, swapping out a few eye-catching design elements. There's always risk with these really opulent interiors that they draw attention to themselves or become a caricature or design porn, Carter said, adding that as a former actor himself, he always ensures the cast is the center of attention. At the same time, some luxury is needed. We want to make sure it feels like billionaires inhabit these spaces, not just millionaires.
Thank you.
And still more from the awards extra, All That Glitters, by Laura Regensdorf, the moody makeup of Euphoria. In the photos, Frazzle Dazzle, creator Sam Levinson wanted to centralize Rue's makeup under her eyes, says Davy, so glitter could reflect like pools of tears. Eye to Eye, Hunter Schafer and Zendaya on set for the season one finale, staged at a school dance. Daniela Davy touches up Schafer's gold foil appliques, an homage to Claire Danes in 1996's Romeo and Juliet. Lashing Out, I wanted to bridge the gap between the fantasy of runway makeup and real life, says Davy, this starburst look included. In the third episode of HBO's transgressive teen drama Euphoria, a lunchroom conversation turns to selfies. They should look classy, but not too arty. Jules, an incandescent Hunter Schafer, tells her best friend, Rue, Zendaya, like I took them with very little thought or effort, but could also be an effing MoMA. Jules is talking about nudes, common currency for a generation navigating sex in the smartphone era, but she could be describing her makeup, dabs of yellow along her arches with a neon red stripe beneath each lower lash. It's Kandinsky by way of Sephora. Euphoria's parade of looks, crystal, embellished cat eyes, shadow and polychrome pastels, psychedelic glitter tears, is more than visual stimulation. It's a call to action, reverberating across the runways and prompting online homages. Mindy Kaling spoke for just about everyone when she tweeted, "Be honest, can I pull off Euphoria eye makeup?" Doniella Davy, the series' 31-year-old makeup department head, thinks so. This isn't about glam. It's about expression and telling the story, she says, describing writer-director Sam Levinson's real passion for makeup as a creative outlet. It's also a finely etched tool for character study. Jules, an ethereal trans girl, wears vivid smudges or delicate line work. For Rue, a quasi-recovering addict partial to hoodies, melancholic glitter is her against-type party accessory. It's beautiful, it's sad, it's complicated, says Davy. Production for season two was set for mid-March when the pandemic put the world on pause. New Euphoria makeup looks have instead turned up on Davy's Instagram, a rare public turn instigated by quarantine. I'm the guinea pig to this whole experiment, Davy says, of her dip into sparkles and candy tones. The lesson of Euphoria comes full circle. It's gotten me to come out of my shell.
Thank you.
More from the awards extra, Between the Lines, by Michael Hogan. The ingenious scripts of Better Call Saul. In the photos, the perfect match. With this scene, Bob Odenkirk's Jimmy and Ray Seahorn's Kim begin a new phase of their relationship, and Better Call Saul enters its endgame. 5 seasons in, AMC's Breaking Bad prequel, Better Call Saul, is still charting its protagonist evolution from slippin' Jimmy McGill, Bob Odenkirk, roguish but good-hearted attorney, to Saul Goodman, a moral underworld lawyer. A descent that's measured in part by Jimmy's interactions with his girlfriend, Kim Wexler, Ray Seahorn. Kim is the only person left in Jimmy's circle of trust. She's an honest attorney, but not above joining Jimmy for the occasional con, as long as the victim has it coming. That's why this page of dialogue, annotated here by executive producer and co-creator Peter Gould, is so pivotal to Saul's arc. It comes shortly after Jimmy surprises Kim and her client with an unethical but effective extortion threat. His crime isn't scamming her client. It's doing so without her knowledge. The betrayal is serious enough that both Jimmy and Kim think their relationship could be over. There's one or two moments in the show that come close to that moment of open-hearted fear and pure feeling, Odenkirk says. No argument or manipulation at play. It's simply his fear coming out, directly and innocently. As Gould's annotations show, Saul's writers trust Odenkirk and Seahorn to make the most of the space between the words. They know each other very well, Gould says. We get to see what they do with the material that we present to them, and we can learn from that. Here, character is a collaboration between writers and actors. The deep dive into the complexities of a human being, Odenkirk says, is what makes it a unique show.
Thank you.
Still more from the Awards Extra and Justice for All. An unbelievable, a dazzling cast tells a true story about a series of brutal rapes and a flawed system by Karen Valby. Photograph by Ryan McGinley. Caitlin Deaver, Merritt Weaver, and Toni Collette as detectives in Unbelievable. Am I going to be okay? That's what a friend texted Susanna Grant within 45 minutes of beginning Grant's acclaimed Netflix miniseries Unbelievable, about a string of sexual assault cases investigated by two detectives who drag a serial rapist to justice. If you haven't yet braved the series, anchored by Toni Collette and Merritt Weaver as the detective dream team and Caitlin Deaver as a rape victim who's further undone by local authorities, you too may be wondering whether you can handle it. Let Grant reassure you, as she did her friend, I'm never interested in stories of relentless despair. I do believe in bravely looking into the dark corners of our society, but never without hope. The show is based on an unbelievable story of rape, a gripping, infuriating article from ProPublica and the Marshall Project, and a subsequent This American Life episode. Deaver was just wrapping the high school comedy Booksmart when she auditioned for her role, a marginalized young woman re-traumatized by a system built on second-guessing victims. She trusted the project's female producers and directors, who had no interest in voyeurism, as well as the female crew members nurturing her on set. I had so much heartache and love for this girl that I lost who I was for the 4 months of filming, she says. But I had all these women behind the scenes, like the women who did my hair and makeup and would bring food and make me lunches in the trailer every day, giving me love and support. Harrowing subject matter aside, the series plays as a riveting procedural with Collette and Weaver in the roles of badass heroes. When Deaver was cast, her first thought was, oh my God, I'm going to work with Toni and Merritt Weaver. And then I found out I wasn't in any scenes with them, she says. Their performances are one of the most powerful things I've ever watched. I genuinely binged the entire series all in one night.
Thank you.
and more from the awards extra, Blood on the Tracks. It took more than 4 years to reinvent Snowpiercer. Bong Joon-ho's movie about class warfare for television, The Key Turned Out to Be Murder, by Anthony Bresnahan. In the photos, Jennifer Connelly as Melanie Cavill, Katie McGinnis as Josie Wellstead, and David Diggs as Andre Layton. The train is 1,001 cars long. It never stops moving. It's carrying the last remnants of human life on a frost-covered earth, and it's strictly divided by the haves and have-nots, with the poorest, most desperate people clinging to life in the tail section and the elites living lives of luxury up front. When Oscar-winning Parasite filmmaker Bong Joon-ho turned a French graphic novel into the 2013 movie Snowpiercer, the train became a relentless metaphor for class warfare. Work on transforming the story for TV began in 2015, but it was an arduous process involving a reshot pilot, a switch to showrunner Graham Manson, Orphan Black, and intensive work to figure out how to tell an expansive new story. The answer to the mystery? To make the new Snowpiercer an actual mystery. Bong, who was not directly involved in the TV series, made an action movie. The new TNT show plays like film noir, with David Diggs, best known for playing Lafayette and Thomas Jefferson in the original cast of Hamilton, as Andre Layton, a Taylee revolutionary who worked as a homicide detective before the world ended. Layton is summoned by the icy train manager, Jennifer Connelly, and granted access to previously forbidden areas to solve a sadistic murder committed on board. The show's procedural aspect allows Layton to move between classes, which in turn lets Snowpiercer delve into themes that powered Bong's movie. Says Diggs, Layton's history of being a black man who was also a police officer in the south side of Chicago is one that I thought about a lot. Having to police communities of people that look like him and are underserved, while still answering to a governing body that maybe doesn't interact with that community as much. He figures out a way to exist in a bunch of different classes. There's an element of Agatha Christie's Poirot to Diggs' character, not only in the way he is looked down upon and underestimated by his suspects, but also in his appetites. Having been starved in the tail section, Layton can't resist snacking on the delicacies that abound in the upper-class cabins as he cracks the most disturbing case imaginable. I cannot tell you what a huge compliment that is, Diggs says of the comparison. I am such a big fan of detective films, and Poirot is, I think, the greatest accomplishment of all time.
Thank you.
This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.